This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Today, I'm not going to take a commercial break, but I do want to thank my sponsors, Glenn Erickson and Bill Larson of Larson & Larson. I know that they all support our military and our troops, and they are very, you know, concerned about all of us knowing the full story of D-Day and appreciating the sacrifices that our many of our fathers, grandfathers gave for us. My own father was in D-Day, and so I want to dedicate this program to him. He was with the 30th Infantry. And a few weeks after D-Day, he received a Silver Star for bravery. And so I am very proud of him, and I am thinking about him today. And so when I was looking for an author or authors that I wanted to talk to, one of the books that immediately came to mind is a fairly new release, I think. It was, I don't remember the exact date, but it was pretty recently. And I wanted to talk about this book because it's really fascinating. It's written by Sarah Rose, and it's called D-Day Girls, The Spies Who Armed the Resistance, Sabotaged the Nazis, and Helped Win World War II. And I thought it would be great to have a perspective on what the women of that era went through, because they did a lot for us, and sometimes they're overlooked in all of these celebrations. So I wanted to talk to Sarah. And Sarah,
hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm so thrilled to have you because I think the book came out just recently in April, right?
Right. It's the end of April. It's only been out for a month.
Yeah, and I got it sometime in May, and I was, as I said, because my father was in D-Day, I've been, you know, very interested in that subject all my life, and, oh, I read your book, and I was really, really just thrilled with it. It's a nonfiction book, but it reads like a novel, and you've done a beautiful job with it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And there's no question that women were the hidden figures of D-Day. We have to remember that France was a very female place because the men were in POW camps and the men had been conscripted to slave labor in Germany. And so France, the home front where D-Day was taking place, was a largely female place. And there were women on the ground leading male troops in Normandy on D-Day when the Allies got there.
Well, you've done a tremendous job with this book. Now, tell us how you got interested in it yourself, and how you selected the women that you cover in this book.
Sure. So I spend a lot of time in Hawaii because I'm a writer who hates being cold, as you might know in Clearwater. And I have a lot of friends in the military there, a lot of female friends, who kind of challenged my notion of what women in male spaces are like. I had this assumption that women in a very masculine environment like the military would be kind of junior men, and they'd be tomboys. And these women aren't. They are flirty, they are feminine, they are girly, they're incredibly credentialed. They didn't cohere to like my preconceived notions. And I thought, gosh, women in war are interesting. Like, they are very much going to war as women, not as dressed up like men or as junior men. I want to write about that. And this was in 2015. I knew that as of January 1st, 2016, in all combat roles in the U.S. Armed Forces, women were finally going to be allowed to participate. That only happened 3 years ago. Knowing that that decision was coming, I thought, okay, I'll find a woman in war story. Women at war, interesting to me, and I want to write about that. I thought I'd get an Afghanistan story or an Iraq story. But once I asked the question, who were the very first women in combat? I came up with the answer that the very first women in combat weren't in Iraq or Afghanistan, not even Vietnam. It was World War II. This force of 39 women who parachuted into France ahead of D-Day to arm and train the resistance.
And it's really an unknown story.
It is. Here it is an utterly unknown story. And though in Britain it's a little better known, I mean, we actually have always heard of this. We know about James Bond. The agency James Bond belonged to was based on this agency in World War II. And we know about Miss Moneypenny. Miss Moneypenny was Vera Atkins, who ran this agency in World War II. We've heard of them, but we've never heard the story told from the point of view of women. And when men tell this story, women get reduced to secretaries and couriers, and their role is diminished, when in fact they were in command of troops. They were armed and in combat. They were unequivocally soldiers.
Wow. It's exciting. It's exciting when you read this story and realize that they went through this training. They had to learn how to parachute. They went through the same thing that the men went through.
They absolutely did. They got all the same training, and it was extremely difficult. They were trained in sharpshooting and encryption and safecracking, hand-to-hand silent combat. They could kill a man 100 ways silently with their bare hands. And they were the very first female combat paratroopers. In September 1942, they are parachuting behind enemy lines, armed, into enemy territory to build up a resistance so that when the Allies came, there would be forces there to harry Hitler from the rear. We have to remember that, like, there was never a given that on D-Day it would be a success. President Eisenhower wrote his resignation letter that night. And what happened was, on the night of June 5th, the BBC sent a message out to all of France saying, this is it, the Allies are coming, D-Day is here. And the French resistance that night, before a single boot hit the ground, had cut roads and bridges and railways 950 times all over France so that Normandy was isolated. Hitler couldn't get his reinforcements to the beaches at all. And that meant that it gave a little bit of a leg up to the arriving Allied forces. And not only that, they also took down telephone wires and underground telecom cables. And that meant that it forced the Nazi command to broadcast troop movements over the air. We had already decrypted the Enigma code, so we could anticipate their troop movements. And that was all the work of the resistance. And that was all work that was in part coordinated and led by women.
It is an amazing story. Tell us, you know, when you really cover five women, but a whole lot of other women in between. But what? Tell us about some of the women that you really discovered and admire.
Sure. So the very first woman I found out about is sort of the most famous. Her name was Odette Sampson. She was a single mother of three girls. Her husband was already seconded to the war when she gets a call from her government, and they said, we need you. You have a skill no one else has. You speak French. You speak fluent, habituated French. She was born in France but married to a Brit, which made her British. And de Gaulle wasn't allowing any French citizens to take on this work. So she had a British passport. She spoke fluent and habituated French. At this point in the war, all the men had been conscripted. All the able-bodied soldiers were at war. They needed someone who spoke French. A woman was the only one who could do that. And they said, would you be willing to go to France? Now, no one would fault any mother who said, no, I have three daughters, and my husband's already at war. I can't orphan them. But she framed her response, and this is what was so interesting to me, in the language of a mother. She said, what happens to my girls if Europe's gone, right? There's not a democracy left on the continent, and then Britain falls too. What happens to them then? What happens to my English daughters if there's no democracy anywhere left in Europe? And so she went, and she went for her girls. So I found out about Odette, and I found that her work behind the lines, you know, as trained as she was as a soldier, was always eminently female. I mean, she fell in love with her commanding officer. She saved his life with a very sort of female story, a kind of romantic tale that when they were in the Nazi grip, spared them for the rest of the war. They survived concentration camps when their comrades didn't. And with Odette in mind, I thought, this is a great story. Then I went to look for her classmates. She was in the very first class of women trained to go behind enemy lines. One of her classmates was André Borel, who had worked on an underground railroad in France. And she'd gotten 65 Allied evaders out. That is, airmen, say pilots who'd fallen in, gotten shot down over France. She helped them out on a body line of 200 resistance, passing them from railroad stop to railroad stop, getting them over the Pyrenees, into Spain, into Portugal, and back to England. Then she got betrayed. So she ends up in London on orders from MI9, and then she says, send me back, train me. Turn me into a soldier. She parishes in September 1942, and she's the very first combat paratrooper. She's assigned to Paris, which is the central kind of communication hub for all the networks that are going to be launched along the Channel Coast. So wherever the Allies arrive, whenever D-Day comes, they will come to an area where she has launched a resistance circuit. And then she, right behind her, 5 seconds behind her, that same night in September, was Lise de Bessac. Lise was about to turn 40. She was single. And she parachuted in 5 seconds behind André. She was in Normandy on D-Day when the Allies arrived, and throughout the summer of 1944, commanding resistance troops behind the lines. And we haven't heard about her. We've heard about Moneypenny, but we haven't heard about Lise.
Well, the way you tell the story, as I said, it you reveal it in a way that I forgot that I was reading, you know, nonfiction, because you do write it so beautifully as a story. You tell the story of these women, and it's just a great read.
Thank you so much. I have this memory, or this realization as I was writing, based a little bit on our current politics, I realized that I don't know how anything ends. And here we are in the middle of a challenging time, and I don't know who is going to win the 2020 presidential election. But historians always know. They always write from the results-oriented perspective. And I realized that nobody lives that way. And that in France, in 1943, everyone expected D-Day was going to come in 1943. They had reason to believe it. The radio was telling them that the Allies were coming back to Europe in 1943. And many of military leaders also thought D-Day was going to come to France in 1943. Only the most senior planners knew that they were going to invade Sicily instead. So July 1943, an announcement goes out on the radio, greatest head fake in history, D-Day isn't arriving in France. It's going to Italy instead. And we know that now, that it was June 6, 1944, but no one at the time could have possibly known, and it was this massive disappointment, and it cost the resistance a lot, because they'd been building up networks really fast, training people quickly, a little insecurely, because they thought D-Day's coming this summer, and if they had known, they might have done things differently. We might have had more survivors, but we can't know in the moment. So I realized once we live history differently than we study history, I wanted to write the book that way. I wanted to write the book as if we didn't know the ending.
Well, that's exactly the sort of tenor of what you got, that there was a tension in your writing, that, you know, we know the end, what happened, but at the time, you know, as you're writing it, you managed to build up that tension so that we feel we're not sure, of course, what's going to happen to these women as we're going along, and that's part, I think, of the fun of reading this book.
I'm glad to hear it, because that was entirely my goal in writing it. Was I wanted the war to be meaningful as a female experience, but not in an academic way. Like, these were women on the ground, and they were falling in love. They were having babies. I mean, there was a real resistance to sending women into combat, in part because every culture on Earth has a combat taboo. Every culture says women don't belong in war and children don't belong in war, and that's universal. So this was a massive break with, like, just tradition to send women. And the other thing they were worried about sending women to war was, A, they would get raped, and B, they might fall in love with their commanding officers. And both A and B did happen. So I needed us to have characters that we believed in and that we, you know, felt compassion for, to give voice to these concerns and these very new moments in women's history.
Because there was resistance. And how did Churchill feel about using women?
Well, Churchill was a man ahead of his time and a great leader. I mean, he genuinely was. And first things that happened was they started assigning women to work on the gun sites in Britain during the Blitz, that there had been such a prohibition against women in war, the Geneva Conventions forbade it, and so they didn't want to have women pulling the lanyards on anti-aircraft artillery, because it would make them killers, and that just wasn't done. But the Blitz spirit, all of Britain, it was their finest hour, everyone had to do their part, and Winston Churchill said, you know what, any general that could save 40,000 soldiers for the front by just putting women on the line would get a medal. Why don't we have women pulling the lanyards on the anti-aircraft artillery that's taking down Messerschmitt? So he said, by all means, and he sent his daughter, Mary, to a gun site in Hyde Park, and she was pulling the lanyards, killing Germans and taking down German airplanes. So he was very ahead of his time putting women in combat. But again, they were in combat on home ground. When it came time for this agency to send women behind enemy lines, to send women into a combat theater, he said, well, sure. Like, why not? What's wrong with that? We can solve a manpower problem with women power. Why wouldn't we? He was very common sense about it. So it got approval from the very highest level of British government.
And it's, I think all of this, remembering the 75th anniversary, is important because perhaps it will enter people's mind how very dire the situation was. I lived in England for quite a few years. When I was young, I bought a cottage in England, and I lived there. And so I had the opportunity to meet many people who were involved, both in D-Day and also with Dunkirk, because I bought a cottage in a little village near Henley-on-Thames, and it was from those villages along the Thames that so many of the little boats that went and saved and rescued the men who were, surrounded in Dunkirk. So I met many of these people. I actually got to be on some of the boats that made that trip to Dunkirk. And so it was when they were telling me about how terrible it was, even here in America, it was hard to understand what London went through, how terrible the bombings were, how many people were killed. And so I think it's great that we're now looking back and bringing this out. And as you do in your book too, you talk about it was a horrific time.
Absolutely. I mean, imagine waking up every single morning and not knowing if September 11th was going to happen again. Because that's what it was like in the Blitz every single night for the first year of the war. And it really traumatized the nation. And at the same time, it brought out the best in the nation. That is Britain at its finest hour, ask anybody. Certainly, I mean, when they talk about Brexit now, they are referring to a kind of spirit from 75 years ago. So it was sort of the worst of times, but it brought out the best of a nation. And part of the reason, too, we don't hear about these women in SOE in America is they became a kind of symbol for the Blitz spirit. And when women get turned into symbols, they stop being remembered for their actual accomplishments. They become remembered for the things that got projected onto them. So the women of SOE became these kind of martyrs to the French and British war because they hadn't really fought on the same side. And these women kind of got held up as Joans of Arc, these symbols of female purity and what kind of sacrifice Britain went through and France went through to save the world. And their actual accomplishments got lost. They actually helped liberate France. They were commanding troops who liberated France.
Now, explain what SOE is for those.
Sure. SOE is a secret agency that, in fact, was the sort of parent agency to our CIA. SOE stood for Special Operations Executive. And it didn't answer to the military. It didn't answer to the civil service. It sort of was its own secret agency within British command that was tasked with raising up armies within the conquered parts of Europe. So remember, after Dunkirk, there is not a regular Allied soldier left on the ground anywhere in Europe. The whole continent just belongs to Hitler. And Churchill, again, has this sort of visionary idea. He says, well, what if we armed the angry, occupied people of Europe? What if we turned them into soldiers? That he'd already been beaten up for years by the IRA. And so he, Sinn Féin at that time, He knew that, like, guerrilla warfare was useful. They'd lived through the Spanish Civil War. Guerrilla warfare was effective. What if they made an agency dedicated to it? What if they built it into their battle plan? What if he could get a force of 200,000 strong ready and armed for the Allied arrival so that Hitler couldn't get his reinforcements to the beaches, so that the, you know, that the Nazis were constantly harried from the rear? And with that in mind, he built battle plans around arming the nations of Europe. What it required, though, was it required leadership. It required people to go in advance, teach kids how to use guns, train them in formation, train them how to attack, teach them how to use demolitions and to take out a railway line or a bridge or a tunnel. And so there was a force, at least in France, of about 425 people. They were actually in all of the occupied nations. And they went in, they parachuted in behind the lines. They were sent containers of weapons and explosives. Then they had to recruit the army, which was one of their biggest, most challenging jobs. And this is where women were extremely good, in a way that were even better than men behind the lines. The men of France, as I said, were in jail. They were POW camps. Hitler didn't let them out throughout the war because he was afraid that any soldiers that had fought him in the Blitzkrieg would rise up during the war. The men who were left got conscripted for slave labor in the various conscription schemes. So there weren't men in France. The men that were there were teenagers and old farmers. And this agency had to go around to these sort of very marginal populations in a starving, war-torn nation and say, we need you to leave your families and your farms. Go live in the woods. Let us train you. Let us turn you into soldiers. You might not come home, but you're going to free France. And women were especially good at this job because they were trained listeners. They were trained caretakers. They could answer the concerns of this very troubled population. Men had to learn on the ground, and they learned that in recruiting, listening and caretaking was a big part of the job. It was a female skill that women are trained from birth and that men had to learn. So it shows us, in some ways, that it's not just that men and women do things differently. When women are brought to the table, they bring assets to the table. And if we stop including them, we are actually hurting our war footing. We are making ourselves less secure and less safe. So this agency realized that if they send women, they had to send women. They didn't want to, but once they did, the women really brought a lot to the table.
Now, of course, this research is just fascinating, what you've done here. Did you visit Normandy?
Oh, I absolutely visited Normandy. I jumped out of an airplane.
Oh.
I took a boot camp. I learned to fire weapons. I built a radio. I tried to learn Morse code. Like, I tried to do a great deal of what these women did in training. Not because I'm sort of George Plimpton, but just because I needed to have a sense of how hard it was. It gave me so much respect for what they accomplished.
Wow. So, yeah, that's real dedication to the art, right?
Yeah. These women were between the ages of 22 and 55, so they really represented almost like the whole scope of kind of active female adulthood. And I thought, well, if a 55-year-old woman can jump out of an airplane, I should at least try.
Oh, definitely. That's great. You know, because I think why your book is it has a spirit to it. As I said, attention in it. I can see that you had your tense moments yourself. It's just a great read, and I want to tell people that they really have to get this book. It's called, I'll repeat it for people. It's real easy. It's D-Day Girls, but the subtitle: The Spies Who Armed the Resistance, Sabotaged the Nazis, and Helped Win World War II. I know it's selling very well. I think it's been It's the kind of book that I'm sure they're going to come to you and say, let's make a movie out of this, because you have really put in so much research and work into it and made it into a really fascinating book that everyone will enjoy. Whether you're just interested in women's rights, or you're interested in war, you're interested in history. There's everything in this book, and I'm really, you know, really thrilled that you were able to join me today for several reasons. One, because I read the Wall Street Journal, so I've seen some of your articles over the years, and I think you're just a terrific writer. But also because, you know, I have a sort of a passion. As I said, I lived in England for quite a few years, and so I love tea, and I believe that you're rather an expert on tea.
I am. I'm one of the world's leading experts on tea. My first book is For All the Tea in China: How England Stole the World's Favorite Drink and Changed History, and it is about the title kind of gives it away. How the British Empire basically broke the Chinese tea monopoly. They sent a spy undercover to China right after the Opium Wars. He was the very first person into China after the Brits won the first Opium War. And he took out tea seeds and tea equipment and tea makers and the entire tea recipe. He took all the intellectual property.
With that in mind, I want to invite you to come back in July, and we're going to talk about that book. Because I think it's great. I love that book. And so I have lots of insights too into that particular subject, because I'm writing a book based on India, and so it's a subject that really intrigues me. So you're going to come back in July, okay?
Marvelous. And thank you so much.
Meanwhile, I want everyone to get D-Day Girls. And what's your website?
www.sararose.com, Sarah with an H.
Sarah with an H, the old-fashioned way. It's so beautiful. And everyone, this book is available wherever books are sold. It's a terrific read, and I want to thank you again for being on the program today, Sarah Rose, and you're going to be here in July, okay?
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All
now.
Right. Take care.
Okay. Bye. Oh, she's so nice. And as I said, when I, she writes for the Wall Street Journal. She writes some wonderful articles about cooking, and I really enjoy her writing. Now, we're going to play a special promo for an author who is local to us, and he has been on the program a number of times, Tim McGee, and he wrote a book about D-Day. And so we could play that. And then after that, I'm going to be talking to a professor who has written a great deal about D-Day. And I'm so happy that she's going to be joining me, Catherine Barbier. We'll be talking to her after this little promo.
Tim McGee's Worthy McGuire is a book that will touch your heart. A gripping tale of a gruff old man who needs to keep a promise made during the horrors of the D-Day invasion. For Worthy, it's a mission of the heart. Will his dysfunctional family stand in his way? Selfish and greedy, they are all he has. Can his quest to find a woman from his past change them? Or will they try to stop him before he can reach the beaches of France where his destiny changed? D-Day is a day that can never be forgotten. Worthy McGuire is a tale of redemption that touches on the importance of a promise made and kept. Available wherever books are sold.
Okay, well, that's for Tim McGee, and I want to thank him so much for this wonderful book. And he is right now in Europe, and I'm looking forward to when he comes back. He's going to come on the program, and we'll talk about Worthy McGuire. It is a wonderful book. A very compelling book. If you're interested, if you have any family history and any relatives who were in D-Day, you will love this book. And if you haven't, you will then learn a great deal. So I really look forward to having Tim back in the studio with me next month sometime. But now I want to turn to a historian. Catherine Barbier is, she's really smart. She's a PhD. I'll let her tell you all about herself, because it's important when we're talking about D-Day. There's so many things that now people are learning. For example, because as I said, I've been involved for a long time in knowing about D-Day. When people hear that there were so many thousands of ships heading all at once across the channel, they're surprised. So I'm just so happy to welcome Catherine to Joy on Paper. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, well, as I said, I will let you explain. You're really smart. I love professors. So tell us what you are. Tell us who you are.
So I'm a professor of history at Mississippi State University. I've been teaching there for 15 years. Before that, I taught for a year in Canada, and I was on a postdoc for 2 years at Yale. And I've written a few books and co-edited others and involved in a lot of projects, including co-editor of an international journal of war and history.
Well, of course, one of your areas of expertise is into, you did a book about D-Day, and let's talk a little bit about what strikes you most that you want people to know about D-Day that you discovered in your research.
Oh, it's D-Day's a story about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. There are lots of soldiers and sailors and pilots and air crew who are involved. Just, you know, on the ground, it's more than a story of the people who planned it. It's about a story about the people who executed it, many of whom don't make it off the beaches.
And, the funny thing is it was such a big thing, but they did manage to keep it secret.
Yeah. Well, a couple of different ways, one of which is that as the soldiers were training for the landing, they weren't told where they were going or what they were doing. But on top of that, there was a deception that provided cover for the invasion preparations, which we can talk more about if you'd like.
Yes, I'd love to, because I know as my father did not talk about the war until really the end of his, you know, life. He rarely talked about it, although he received a Silver Star. He was just an ordinary grunt. He did not want to be. As a matter of fact, after he received his Silver Star, he could have had a promotion and he could have gone up the chain, but he just wanted to be with the regular soldiers. He sort of looked like Jimmy Stewart. He was tall and lanky, and he was well known in with his men that his sort of nickname was called No Danger, because he was a little bit older than the 19-year-olds. He was already almost 30, and he just would walk ahead of everybody down these dusty roads in France, and he would turn around and he'd say, "No danger." And the guys would follow right in his footsteps, you know, because he didn't know where there would be a landmine.
Right.
But he didn't talk about it, you know.
But I think that he wasn't unusual in that. I think most of the men who fought in the Second World War came home just ready to try and readjust and get back to their normal lives, and they don't talk about it much. It's only decades later that they start talking about it. And in many cases, you know, women who served in the military during the war were discouraged from talking about their experiences. So there wasn't an emphasis on them coming back and telling their story. It was more they've done a good job, they have defeated the Germans and the Italians and the Japanese, and now let's go back to normal life.
So, and as you said, when he was training in south of in the southern part of England, and they were training and they were, you know, practicing, he didn't know where he was going to go until he went. So how did they manage to do all this deception?
Well, they do a couple of things, one of which is they understand that there's going to be information leaking, and so in some units they suggest that the soldiers are going to the desert, or they're going to mountainous areas. And so they receive certain kind of training and they receive certain kind of equipment that suggests that they're going somewhere other than where they're going. But beyond that, there was a big deception plan called Fortitude that had two components, a smaller component, Fortitude North, in which there were bases and training set up in Scotland and in Northern Ireland with the idea that these troops were going to land in Norway. They succeed in kind of in tying down German troops in Norway. The Germans have to defend a 3,000-mile coastline. And there are a number of commando raids that the British launch against Norway. So it's questionable about whether or not the Germans actually thought that there was going to be a real invasion attempt in Norway. But whether they did or not, they kept troops there. They rotate them in and out, but they still kept about 12 divisions in Norway for the rest of the war. But then the big part of the deception was Fortitude South, which is based in southeast England, and was reinforcing something the Germans already thought. The Germans thought that when the Allies invade France, that they're going to come at Calais. And so this was designed to reinforce that idea. And they do it a number of different ways. They set up camps. They have landing craft on the waterways. They try to create the illusion of troops actually there. And there are very few there just manning the deception. So they have boats that deliver mail, supposedly, to the landing craft that are in water. They have campfires set with seasons. It seems like they're cooking. They put out laundry. Next to the landing craft, they have some oil slicks in the water. They're actual vessels that are, you know, doing what vessels do on the water. And that's part of it. Then they also bombard stations that suggest training, practicing on loading and offloading of vessels in preparation for the invasion. Some of that information was sent in code, but not all of it was, because they want the Germans to get this information and reach certain conclusions. The problem is they bombarded with so much that there's not a lot of evidence that the Germans decoded a lot of it. They were just so overwhelmed with the amount of information that was coming across the airwaves. And what the Germans do is they launch reconnaissance flights over the southeast coast of England, and they're seeing these camps. But by May, very few German reconnaissance flights are getting over the coast to even see these camps, but the Allies continued the deception anyway on the off chance that the game would be up, right, if the Germans realized that they're not actual troops in that area. And then the final way that they perpetuate this idea is they make use of double agents. The Germans sent a number of agents into the UK. Most, if not all of them, were caught. The British contend that all of them were caught. Some of them were put in prison. Some were executed. But a number of them were turned into double agents and start transmitting information back to the Germans. Initially, accurate information that the Germans could check in order to establish their credentials. But then by the time the deception is implemented, they're sending a lot of false information about the location of troops, about the buildup of aircraft, of vessels, that sort of thing, to perpetuate this idea that there's this huge force in southeast England that's getting ready to cross the channel at Calais.
Well, it worked. I mean, we managed to more or less surprise them. Looking back at it, for people who have been to England, and normally when you cross the channel, you do land at Calais, and it seems like the logical place to do an invasion. So I can see that, you know, the Germans would think, well, it's too logical. They'll probably not come here. But then because it's, you know, too logical, this is where they'll come. I can see where they would get, you know, really like, what are we going to protect?
Well, they get that they have to protect more than just that area, right? Which is why Rommel's on the scene constructing the Atlantic Wall. Because the idea is that they have to protect the whole coastline of France. Hitler issued a directive in November of 43 in which he talks about the fact that the Allies are going to launch multiple, and it's going to be really difficult to tell which one is the real one. They're looking beyond Calais, and certainly like Rommel and Rundstedt are looking more and more at Normandy on the eve of the invasion. They just are willing to buy into the reinforcement of what they were already thinking. If when they were planning the invasion of the UK, they were going to cross at Calais. And so the idea was that because that was logical to them, that's what the Allies are going to do. And the Allies are intercepting a lot of German communications and decoding it. And so because of the ultra intercepts, they can use that information to further reinforce what the Germans are thinking. And you know, if people are so used to an idea for months and months and months, it's hard to entertain the idea that it might not be true, that something else might actually be correct.
So how did you get involved with the research into D-Day?
So I grew up hearing my dad talk about his good-looking cousin who didn't come back from war, and talking about the fact that he was in high school during the war, and his high school was located on the Mississippi River, and you could see U.S. naval vessels coming up the river to go to Avondale to be repaired after tangling with U-boats in the Gulf of Mexico. And so I grew up hearing about this and watching, you know, classical movies. What are classical movies today, right? Movies about the war. And so when I started graduate school, I knew I wanted to do something about World War II and probably something about the D-Day invasion, but I didn't know what. And so I talked to my advisor, and he said, you know, I could do something about an aircraft, or I could do something about this deception plant. And I started to do some digging, and I just became fascinated with this idea of how did they make this work, right? The rest, as they say, is history.
And so you traveled to Normandy?
I have. I did when I was in graduate school. I did again a few years ago. I did most of my research in what used to be called the Public Record Office is now the National Archives of the United Kingdom in Kew, England. Did a little bit of research at the U.S. National Archives of College Park. But this deception plan came out of a committee, the London Controlling Section, which was created by the Brits, had an American on it, but it was basically a British plan that the Americans helped implement.
Well, it's an amazing thing when you do go to Normandy. I'm so happy that they had such great coverage of it today, particularly, so that people can get some idea of the enormity of what we did. Mm-hmm. You know, as I said, because my father wouldn't talk about it, I knew it mostly also through black and white films. I was, mm-hmm. as a teenager, I was obsessed with those black and white war movies. I loved them. I loved to watch them, and I both the you know movies and also the newsreels. And I was always like, is that daddy? Is that daddy? You know, when they're showing guys walking along dusty roads, and I, you know, tried to identify him. I asked him one time. I said, "Well, do you ever, you know, look at those newsreels?" And now he didn't want to look at them. And you know, it was just something he wasn't interested in looking, because I wanted to. I said, "Well, you must be in one of them. You must be in one of them," because you know. And but he never would look at them. And so I think it was a good experience to go through that and really to look at you see the black and white movies, although they're black and white, the battle ones, you feel like they're in color. You know, you feel like you can almost see the blood when you're watching these films.
Well, and some of the ones coming out of Hollywood, certainly right after the war, used actual footage, like 12 O'Clock High. Some of the footage in that film, which came out in 1949, I believe, uses some actual footage that was filmed by crews, right, who were on these missions. But, you know, I think that to some extent, some of the men didn't think that people back home would really understand their experiences or would want to know about their experiences. And perhaps one of the best movies that illustrates that is The Best Years of Our Lives.
Oh, yes.
Which is about the vets coming back.
Exactly. It is a great film. One of the things I wanted to, you mentioned where you did some of your research, there are still vets alive. They're very old mm-hmm. now, but in many families, you still have relatives who either they were in the war, or even if they were just here at home, they have memories. They have letters. So one of the reasons I do this program, it's called a program, you know, for writers and those who dream of writing. And so people will come to me and, oh, I always heard these stories, like you heard a story from your father. And I tell people, write it down. And if you have living relatives who went through that period, because it's also interesting, even if they were here in the States, to know what was going on, to know what they were listening to. What did they know about the invasion? What did they know about this thing? So how would you suggest to people to start doing their research?
I think a good place to start would be to go to a museum, like the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. There's also the Institute on World War II and the Human Experience at Florida State. And so that would be a good place to start. It's also a good place, the Institute or the Museum would be a good place to go if there's memorabilia or letters they want to donate. Or to an archive at their local university. We've taken some collections at Mississippi State when the veteran had some sort of connection to state and the family wanted to then donate those papers to our special collections, which then means that they're available for anybody to once they're cataloged, available for people to come and do research. Also reach out, you know, to an historian who focuses on the Second World War at a nearby institution. In the last couple of years, there was a group that was put together out of King's College London called the Second World War Research Group, and it consists of scholars who are doing research on the Second World War, and they're trying to connect scholars around the world, and they've started regional branches, and so we've got a brand new North American branch. We've had one workshop last September at my institution, and we have one coming up this coming September at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans.
And what's it called again so people can remember it?
The Second World War Research Group.
Okay. Well, I'm sure they have a website and people can go there and meanwhile start collecting letters, and taping interviews. Nowadays, of course, everybody has a cell phone, and if you meet somebody old, and one of the nice things to do if you have some spare time is to volunteer at a VA hospital. And it's a wonderful thing to do. It's a wonderful way to meet you know, the men and women who have served our nation, and also, you know, to talk to them about these events and perhaps to videotape them and get their permission to use their stories, because it's something that we have to remember.
Yes, and I know that the museum in New Orleans has a department where they go out and conduct oral histories with veterans. And there are a number of people, like you said, who volunteer at the museum, including vets. So, you know, that's another resource that people may not realize. And that's going to a museum that specializes in the Second World War, where they have the facilities to actually, and people who are trained at conducting those interviews.
Exactly. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today, Professor Catherine Barbier. You have some books on the internet. Are you writing anything more? How about a novel coming from you?
Well, not a novel, but I am in the early stages of writing a short biography of a woman who was a double agent in the Second World War.
Okay. Well, when you're ready to publish it, and let me know, and we'll have you back here on Joy on Paper. I want to thank you so much for talking about the deception program and just helping people understand the importance of this anniversary, the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay. Well, the hour went so quickly. And as I said, D-Day Girls by Sarah Rose is a wonderful book, and I hope you'll get it. It's just a great read. Now, Professor Barbieri has a few books there on the internet, but I think she has to do some updating, and get some new stuff published. But it was wonderful of her to join me today because I wanted to hear a little bit about this deception program, and it was really nice to know that we managed to deceive the Germans 75 years ago, and our guys landed on the beaches. It was still horrific. And I did not realize in that very first wave until I listened this morning that they had 90% of them in the very, very first wave, the first guys off the beach, were killed or injured. So these guys were something. They were something special, and it's wonderful that we are honoring them today. And we should honor them every day. And remember, if you want to donate to the Veterans Association or to USO. USOs are still very active, and of course they were very important in World War II. And do you realize how many donuts they served in France after D-Day? So it's a funny story, and I might actually have one of the people who was involved in that program, the donut program, on the program. She's very old, but I just discovered her. So one of the things I want to, again, always tell you, go to my website, radio-joyonpaper.com, and I'm trying to get these interviews up as fast as I can. It's a process, so if you have to bear with me. If I don't get them on the next day, I try to get them within a week. But I do hope that you will go to my website and also to my Facebook page and like me. It's Radio Joy on Paper. And I do appreciate it. And again, I want to thank Bill Larson of Larson & Larson. He's our legal eagle. He's going to be here on the 20th to answer your legal intellectual property questions. And if you have any, please send me an email. It's patsy.radio@gmail.com, or go to my website, and he will answer your intellectual property questions, because they do pop up from time to time. And I tell you, you have to be out there and protecting yourself, because I just recently talked to an author who got into a lot of trouble using another author's name. So it's always fascinating to talk to Bill Larson. Anyway, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're really, really lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a streaming video, a major motion picture, or perhaps a television series. You never know, but you have to start by writing a page a day. And when you do that, in a year, you'll have 300 and, I don't know, some pages, because probably you won't work every day. But that's all you have to do. You have to try. Okay, and meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed. He got everybody on the line today, and it's been a big day here in Tent Talk Radio Network because we are celebrating D-Day. And thanks, Ed. He's saluting me. Oh, yes, we have to salute today because it is D-Day. Bye-bye now.